This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Looking for some career advice? Wondering how to get ahead or how to strike a better work-life balance? Visit our site to read how others are doing it. Use our individual development plan tool, access topic-specific article collections, or search for an exciting new job. Science Careers, produced by Science and AAAS, is a free website full of resources to help get the most out of your career. Visit sciencecareers.org today to get started. Welcome to the Science Podcast for July 10th, 2015. I'm Sarah Crespi. In this week's show, Nick Bartlett talks about building soft robots with a combustible surprise inside. And David Grimm is here with some of our latest online news stories.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Now we have David Grimm, editor for our daily news site. He's here to talk about some recent online stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on how pollution can influence the weather. Here in D.C., we have storm warnings, and so you bring an umbrella. And we also have pollution warnings, days where they ask us to stop driving and ride the bus. Not that many of us do that. But now scientists are starting to make a direct connection between pollution and storms. One of the first such connections has been made after some severe flooding in China. Dave, can you set the scene for us?
Yeah, so this is July of 2013, and some of the worst flooding to hit China in 50 years strikes Sichuan province, and they get a lot of rain. They get, over the course of 5 days, 73 centimeters of rain, peaking with a single day where they had 29 centimeters in just one day. Rivers burst their banks, poured through the city streets, washed away homes, factories, and bridges. 200 people died and another 300,000 were displaced.
Wow. Let's go back to pollution for one second. What kind of effects can pollution or particulates in the air have on the weather?
So we know that aerosol particles, which sort of make up pollution in the air, they can have a variety of effects. They can reduce or delay rain. Sometimes they can make thunderstorms more intense. But nobody really knows exactly how this happens.
Why do researchers think that pollution played a role in these severe storms in Sichuan province?
Well, the Sichuan Basin, which is surrounded by mountains, it traps smoke that's billowing from the industrial centers in the region. It's notorious for dirty air. And so researchers started to wonder, well, might this sort of massive pollution that's happening, this air pollution that's happening in this area, especially since also we had massive flooding in this area, could the two be linked?
And how do they decide that there was or wasn't a link there?
The researchers ran a couple of forecast models, some with this pollution, some without this pollution. And what they found is a pretty good match for when there was a lot of pollution, they saw a lot more flooding. And the reason they think this happened is because the pollution prevented rain clouds from forming over the basin during the day, which had the effect of leading to more intense rainfall in the mountains in the evening. So it's sort of like the rain was kind of building up and then sort of unleashing all at one time. And when you have that much rain falling at one time, you're going to have a lot of flooding.
In this case, it's not just pollution, but also geography that's important to the event?
Right. The basin and the mountains actually play a big role in trapping this pollution and actually causing this weather pattern. So it's not the case where wherever you have pollution in the air, you're going to have this type of effect. The geography also plays a role.
Are weather forecasters going to be taking pollution into account now?
Well, that's one thing the researchers suggest is that, you know, potentially if we want to especially forecast catastrophic weather events like this, we really want to pay attention to not just the rain and the clouds that are up in the air, but the pollution as well.
Next up, we have a story on mapping drug violence in Mexico. In 2006, the Mexican government went to war with the country's drug cartels. Since then, over 100,000 people have died or disappeared as a result. Researchers have been analyzing these numbers in order to better understand the spread of violence. Dave, what kind of analysis did they do?
The researchers dove into the official reports of drug-related homicides in Mexico, and they zeroed in on locations and dates that were really mapped to these massive outbreaks of violence. And they went month by month to build this complicated network that would illustrate where the epicenters of the violence were, how the violence from one city may have related to the violence from another city. And they were looking for these broad geographical patterns.
And when they did map these incidences and they looked at them over time, what kind of patterns did they see?
They saw that what they call narco-related violence, which is this drug-related violence, does not spread by geographical proximity. And what that means is it doesn't really spread like an epidemic. It doesn't start one place and kind of spread out from that place. Like you can imagine maybe like a medieval war that slowly expands across the country. That's not actually what the researchers observed. Instead, it seems like the violence synchronizes in cities sometimes that are thousands of miles apart. You can have these concomitant eruptions of violence in places that are really not geographically connected. These places are kind of like nodes where the violence synchronizes in cities that are far apart without affecting some of the cities that are in the middle.
Did they see a growth in time in the number of these violent incidences?
Yeah, from 2008 to 2011, they really saw this uptick in violence. In 2008, you could travel north to south by only visiting violent cities. In 2010, in 2011, you started to have that problem from east to west as well. And actually by 2011, you could cross Mexico from north to south and from east to west, driving only through places with a higher death rate than the one reported in Iraq during the U.S. invasion. So there was certainly an uptick in violence over time.
Now that they've mapped out these super violent areas, is this something that the government can then take and tackle?
That's the question. You know, now that we know where these nodes are, does it make sense to disrupt the nodes, or might that make things actually worse? Because if you disrupt the nodes, could the kingpins splinter into these smaller factions, and then you might actually have a worse problem than you had before?
One thing I noticed when looking at this article, there's actually a slideshow along with it, is that it stops in 2011. It's 2015. Where is the rest of the data?
The researchers have been saying that a lot of official records have been disappearing, especially those related to violence, drug violence. So that's making it a lot harder to compile data on what's going on right now.
Lastly, we have a story on drugs and altruism. I know there are a lot of psych experiments with people shocking themselves or others. What I didn't know was that, in general, people do have a preference for giving themselves a shock over giving someone else a shock. They avoid hurting others to their own detriment. But that's not what this study is about exactly. Right, Dave? Why were they shocking people in this case?
The researchers are trying to figure out if some common medications actually influence our moral judgment, if they actually, in this case, influence our willingness to shock somebody else instead of shocking ourselves.
And what drugs did they look at?
They were looking at a couple of drugs. One was an antidepressant drug called citalopram. The other one was a drug for Parkinson's called levodopa. So citalopram enhances serotonin levels in the brain, and serotonin appears to keep us civil. It's reduced in the brains of violent offenders, for example. Meanwhile, levodopa increases dopamine levels, and dopamine has been shown to prompt aggression in animals, and it's actually elevated in a certain part of the brain of people with psychopathic behavior.
And so these people were given these drugs, which are safe, obviously, yes. But they were then asked to shock themselves or others?
The volunteers were given a number of choices. They could be given a certain amount of money to shock themselves. They can be given a certain amount of money to shock somebody else. And at the end of the experiment, one of the decisions they made had a consequence. They got shocked or somebody else got shocked.
And in general, as I mentioned at the beginning, people are averse to hurting other people and will pay a little extra to hurt themselves.
And that's pretty much what the researchers found. An average people that received the placebo were more willing to hurt themselves and hurt somebody else. Similarly, for people that were given, those people taking citalopram were just more averse to causing harm in general, and that meant more averse to causing harm to themselves, but also more averse to causing harm to other people. But really interestingly, the levodopa group, these people who were taking this drug seemed to make people just as willing to shock others as they were willing to shock themselves.
In the case of the antidepressant, people were less likely to hurt other people or themselves. But in the case of the Parkinson's drug, where people were getting elevated levels of dopamine, they seemed to be a little bit more aggressive. Is that something that someone who's taking these drugs for a good reason would have to worry about?
The researchers say probably not, or at least we don't have enough information. Part of the problem is we don't actually know what impact these drugs were having on these people's brains. We actually don't know if they were impacting the levels of serotonin and dopamine during these experiments, which is what you'd really want to know. One of the researchers says, the last thing I want is for people who are taking these drugs for medical reasons to become concerned about the implications of the study for their own decision-making. In other words, don't change the drugs you're taking just based on this one study.
Okay, what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about why pandas are so lazy. Also, in preparation for the New Horizons spacecraft reaching Pluto next week, we will be doing a number of Pluto stories, including profiles of the people behind the mission, a Pluto quiz, and a few other items about Pluto. So be sure to check out the site for all that good stuff. Also, for Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about why two California schools are in a legal clash over an Alzheimer's grant. Also, a story about why the United Kingdom is interested in sending more people into space. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. Soft robots may be able to squeeze into tight spots, but first we need to get them moving. One of the challenges of working with pliable parts is efficiently transferring energy to them. I spoke with Nick Bartlett about his team's work making jumping soft robots that run on small explosions.
So in this work, we are interested in looking at a new fabrication strategy for soft robotics. So in a typical soft robot, you're going to actually have a number of rigid components to drive and power the robot itself. We were looking at a new way to attach these rigid components to the soft body itself. And what we came up with is a 3D printing approach in which we print a material gradient that ranges from very soft to very rigid to connect these dissimilar materials.
What do your robots look like?
This particular robot essentially consists of concentric hemispheres. So you can think of two bowls sitting inside of each other, and the space in between these hemispheres is injected with a combustible gas, which is then sparked, and the robot essentially balloons out, pressing against the ground and launching itself into the air.
And they have a couple of unique features. As you mentioned, there's some combustion going on, and they're soft. Why make a soft robot?
So soft robotics in general has a number of advantages over traditional robots. Being soft, they're inherently safe. When you think of a traditional robot, you might think of a factory floor with a huge car assembly plant with a huge welding arm flying around. But when you think of that, you don't think of people because those types of robots are very dangerous. So soft robots is sort of the opposite of that. You know, they're using these soft, flexible materials, which are inherently safe and allow for human interaction. This robot specifically, being soft, is going to make it more robust and more resilient. It's going to be able to adapt to an environment. It's also going to be cheap to produce and very quick to manufacture.
We hear a lot about robots that are based on animals these days. Are soft robots, or yours in particular, modeled on any animal out there?
Sure. So specifically, we drew inspiration from a number of biological examples, such as a octopus beak. Octopus is an entirely soft-bodied animal, except for this rigid beak, and it actually connects these hard and soft materials through a stiffness gradient similar to what we used in our robot.
So that's the challenge that you're really working with here, is how to attach something hard to something soft, make it move and not damage itself. Can you talk about how you tackle that challenge?
Sure, yeah. So as you said, any soft robot to date is going to necessarily require some rigid components. So the question is, how do you attach these things? So what we did was we used a advanced 3D printer that's able to print multiple different materials, and we printed a gradient that ranges from very rigid to very soft, so it eases the transition from rigid to soft in our robot.
On top of this, why use combustion to power your machine?
So basically, there are two reasons why we would want to use combustion. First of all, it's a very high energy density way to transport a robot, so you get a lot of bang for your buck, essentially. And second, it allows for very fast locomotion. So typical soft robots have been traditionally very slow, and combustion is a good way to allow them to move more quickly.
And how easy is it to control something that has a little mini explosion going on inside of it?
Right. So this aspect definitely took a little bit of tweaking, some experimenting there. But once you dial in the parameters and you stay consistent with how much fuel you inject and the timing of the sparks, it's actually rather consistent.
Can you have multiple explosions in a row?
Sure. We did a number of tests where we would have a series of combustion events and get multiple jumps with a single timing sequence.
How high can they jump?
This obviously depends on how much fuel you inject, and the more fuel you inject, the more susceptible to damage the robot is. But in some of our tests, we achieved jumps of over 6 feet.
We've seen 3D printing really push forward a bunch of different fields. How has it helped in this particular design and the kind of testing that you had to do?
In soft robotics specifically, it's a very new field, so there are a lot of different design spaces available. Essentially, there's something to be found in every direction you look. So something that's very important is being able to iterate on your design quickly and try to explore some of that space as much as you can. So 3D printing really allows you to very quickly iterate your design, try something new, test to see what its advantages and disadvantages are, and then iterate again.
So what would one use a soft hopping robot for?
You could think of a number of potential applications. Particularly fun one that I like to think of is space exploration. So if you can imagine exploring the moon, something that has rough terrain and especially low gravity would be particularly well suited for a robot such as this. Another example would be, you know, a disaster scenario back here on Earth, building collapse or something, searching for survivors.
You see there's just tons of different spaces that this field can move into. What are some of the directions it's going in?
Some of the different directions for soft robotics. Right now, there are mobile robots, such as the one that we've discussed in this work here. Another really interesting field is wearable robotics, where people will physically put on, you know, stretchable sensors or actuators to augment their lifestyle or to assist if they have some sort of disability.
So like a soft exoskeleton.
Yeah, exactly.
Very cool. Nick, thanks so much for talking with me.
Great, thanks very much.
Nick Bartlett and colleagues write about soft jumping bots in this week's issue. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org or tweet to us at Science Magazine. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and many other places, or listen to us on the Science site. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.